You are now tuning in to the Own the Build podcast. Join C-Link's very own Paul Hemming, where each week he interviews experts from the world of construction and asks all the important questions around intelligent construction management.
Hello and welcome to episode 159 of the Own the Build podcast with me, Paul Hemming. Today I am sharing an old ebook that I co-wrote with five specialist M&E contractors titled Your Guide to Professional Value Engineering of Mechanical and Electrical Packages. And you're going to understand why when I end up getting to the meat of this show, but kind of as professionals, we spend thousands of pounds, hundreds of thousands of pounds, millions of pounds procuring packages each year. And there'll be some days for you, there certainly was for me, where a lack of clarity on certain technicalities and details of specific specialist packages would have been much needed, no more so than with M&E. And this, the purpose really of that ebook was to focus on technical solutions that can be found in mechanical and electrical engineering. It segues me nicely onto today's guest, as ever. And in the studio today, I am joined by Doug Johnson, who is founder and director at Mesh Energy, an independent and trusted services consultant focusing on providing innovative, sustainable energy services to clients, architects, and the construction industry generally. Doug, welcome to Own the Build, mate. How's it going?
All good. Thank you very much. Cheers, Paul. Great to be on the podcast and talking to you.
The pleasure is all mine. Now, I'm going to have to caveat this entire conversation, and I'm going to have to say to you, you're going to have to be particularly nice to me and reasonable, because services and technical aspects is something which doesn't come naturally to me. It's an area where I am no expert, is what I would say. I'm much more heavily focused on the commercial contractual side of things in construction. And you've probably come across many QSs just like me and rolled your eyes and thought, here we go, here comes another one trundling through the door. So you're gonna have to be nice to me today. But just
I'll try.
Yeah, I already get the sense that you're not gonna try that hard. but I've obviously tried to give you an introduction there and an introduction to your business. So just tell us all about what it is that you do.
Yeah, so really in a nutshell, our business or the business that I started and the one that we still going with and is ever evolving is really about working on behalf of the client to simplify, clarify, add some kind of numerical basis to, you know, an ever more complicated, sustainable construction process. And, you know, the offerings of the business are now, you know, quite expansive. But, you know, where we started out was, you know, really around just being there, working with the client rather than trying to sell product and those kinds of things. But yeah, you know, we're working, as others are, to decarbonize the built environment for a wide range of clients, whether they, you know, private or, you know, businesses or anything in between.
That's great, Doug. So just trying to understand and contextualize where and how you kind of work in the, less so with the domestic client, more so with a commercial client, how would it be that you are, who employs you, and like at what stage of the process do you get involved at the moment?
Okay, so this has really changed over the last kind of few years, and historically we would get a phone call from an architect. They'd got planning permission for a scheme, and you know, a lot of the design team was already well ensconced, and we were being approached to do, you know, REBA stage 4 mechanical and electrical design, to which the go up to tender and get prices back for it. And certainly over the last 2 years, that has changed quite considerably. So again, we'd get a phone call from the architect. In fact, we go out of our way to build relationships with architects. We understand, generally speaking, architects are very well trusted by their clients and in early doors. So we get a phone call from the architect, and really now increasingly, it used to be stage 3 because people needed key information for planning, be that certain performance calculations, embodied carbon calculations, overheating calculations more recently. But we've got plenty of architects now, and that's creeping back to REBA stage 2. So they've got the massing of the scheme. they know they can't put it off. They're going to have to do something. So it's better now talking to, you know, a kind of a key, you know, design team member to help them out so they don't go too far down the wrong path.
Yeah, it's really interesting because the language that you used there, you said in reference to stage four, stage three, but now stage two is where you start to get involved. You said they know they can't put it off, whether that's clients, architects, design teams, right? Is that how you feel it was in the past, that it was like, well, we'll deal with that when we have to, when we need to? It's like a more like a, not a nuisance, but a nice to have, as opposed to now it's absolutely critical.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, money makes the world go round, and certainly on commercial schemes, it was very, very obvious that, you know, money would be spent only if it absolutely had to be, and if a planner or there isn't some condition that says you've got to work out what the embodied carbon is of this building, people wouldn't do that because that's going to save them X thousands of pounds in the process. You know, domestically, it's completely driven because you've got somebody who's sold a business or they've saved up a load of money or they've inherited a load and they've got this kind of aspiration for a net zero home. So they kind of get carried away with all kinds of things that are really important to them.
Who's better to work for?
That's a good question. I think it depends what drives you. Certainly,
different challenges.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe I shouldn't answer that question. But
keep it to yourself.
But let's put it this way. Domestic clients are more aspirational than commercial clients. But going back to your original comment there, commercially, it's a lot more cutthroat, of course. You know, people are trying to make profit that, you know, and end up with some money at the end of the project. So if it's not being asked for, why do it? But now it's a foregone conclusion. And you tend to find the people that have the most successful projects are those that aren't watching every penny. They properly understand what's coming and they make sure they've got the right team members on board, and it's just far more considered.
Yeah No, that makes sense, and it resonates or rhymes maybe with what we hear from people at all different stages, that whereas before it's not, I wouldn't say this, but, you know, it's not that it was considered a nice to have, but it wasn't essential, was it? Sustainability, embodied carbon, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas now it's very different. Can I ask, because I might be wrong here, but just interested in the context of the rest of our conversation, is your business's journey, Mesh's journey, was it a journey from a traditional services engineer, consultant, when it was founded initially, and now it's much more in sustainability? Like, could you just frame it for the simple QS mind, my simple QS mind, for all of our listeners?
No, I think this is important because I think this really differentiates some of the more progressive businesses in the space at the moment. And I'm biased because, you know, every business has their own, like every fingerprint, they have their own different journey and the reason they've got to where they've got to. I mean, back in the day, you know, when I first got into sustainability, that was, I worked for an installation company, a company that was actually, you know, on the muddy building sites, putting stuff in. I came in as a project manager, you know, dealing with, you know, builders and JCT contracts and clients whinging that you weren't there, or, you know, at a particular time, you know, like 6 a.m. on site because they were expecting you there, you know, all that kind of nonsense. And that's where we kind of cut our teeth. And once I realized that the clients and architects and design teams needed more help, you know, to make their sustainable projects more successful, I studied engineering, but it wasn't building services. I did aeronautics and stuff like that. I came from a more kind of traditional mechanical background. But we actually started from mainly from the sustainability element. So, you know, right at the early days of the business, I was, you know, if you were building a house, Paul, and you were thinking about putting a gas boiler in, I could write your report to say, yeah, you can put a gas boiler in. And I'd do a heat loss study of the house and we'd work out what it would cost to put a gas boiler in. But there are other low carbon alternatives and there are government grants available. So we were kind of coming up with options. It had nothing really to do with building services. It had more to do with the financial model. What's the right thing to do at this crossroads in a particular project? And what did the client want to get out? You know, did they want to change direction? Did they want to do something different? And so we came from a very client-focused end, built out doing, you know, compliance calculations and, you know, more and more and more sophisticated number crunching. Again, not really services-based, but before too long, people are saying, well, I love the idea of putting in a heat pump. like, how big is it? Where does it go in my plant room? How much of my garden have I got to dig up? Or where can an air source heat pump unit go? And so we kind of got sucked into it. So we've come into this kind of holistic building services, building performance end, from the building performance end, and building design is, you know, is part of that offering. Whereas there are many, you know, more traditional building services companies that are trying to go the other way and get into sustainable design. And, you know, they're finding their own path going that way.
No, that's really interesting. And in the context of what we're going to discuss then, I think the fact is, that's what I wanted to ask. It really helps me understand, like, your ethos, or more like your mentality on projects and how your business has grown. But I'm interested to talk about the design process from your perspective. I've got my own perspective. My perspective is coming from subcontracting background. So I was a commercial manager at a large subcontractor, always brought in for very focused conversations about facades, et cetera, knowing there was a much wider conversation that was obviously going on, led by client, architect, et cetera. And my relationship with, or my company's relationship with, the different consultants on that team was pretty fragmented, pretty sporadic. And I always felt that often design meetings and the wider design process, which on big jobs, or on any job, to be honest with you, sets the tone for the rest of the job and whether or not it's going to be successful. So it's uber critical, but it doesn't have that same project management mentality. It's almost like, yeah, the design's kind of cracking on, and then it gets to site and everyone's like, right, now we're going to focus on X, Y, and Z. It was almost how I felt about it. Now, that might be with my subcontract glasses on, but that's kind of how I felt about it. Can you just talk to us about the design process generally, when you guys should come into it? You've talked about stage 2, 3, and 4, but, you know, I'm thinking where you've got this slightly bigger commercial clients. How do you see the design process, and how can we make it better?
Yeah, so I think the design process at the moment needs improving. It is getting better, and people are learning from their mistakes, generally speaking. I think a lot of the issues with design at the moment is still very much around people getting too possessive about their specialist areas, and feeling as if they talk to too many people, that in some way waters down their kind of value for that particular project, because it sounds like they don't really know what they are talking about, and they need everybody's opinions to kind of come up with an answer. The flip side is that you end up with a traditional design process on a commercial job for buildings that are not traditional anymore. There are one of the, you know, we'll potentially talk about risks, you know, kind of later on, but one of the biggest issues are that the buildings are getting ever more integrated and complex, and that, you know, there seems to be an explosion of specialists that have to get some of these commercial buildings done. And so the design process as we kind of know it is very rapidly becoming outdated, because the design historically has been quite linear. You know, the client would talk to the architect. The architect would make some key decisions, bring in the structural engineer, you know, might have a planning consultant. Okay, so tick, the building's going to stand up and got some planning advice. And you end up with the people who could have helped being talked to months and months and months down the line. And you realize that you've penned yourself into a corner because you weren't having the right conversations.
Yeah, I mean, I think it feels uber simplistic, right? Because with whether you're talking to the architect at design stage, whether you're talking to the main contractor at procurement and specialist contracting stage, it often feels like things are uber simplified by saying early engagement, you know, particularly with main contractors, subcontractors, get the subcontractors in early and everything will be absolutely fine. And I'm not saying that's what you're saying on the design side as well, but I've heard so much that, you know, we need to get the design team in properly engaged. Don't cut corners in January, because by the time it's April, you're going to be paying the price for it. I know I'm really oversimplifying it, but in some respects, it could be as simple as that if you are engaged in the right way. So my question is to you, and I'm simplifying things again here, typical commercial projects, architect employed by the client, structural engineer is employed as well. At what stage should you be first engaged and then involved in like detailed conversations so that, you know, you can balance the commercial aspect of the money with the benefit of the design?
I would seriously say the latest that any you know, sustainability consultant should be involved is REBA stage two. In we are finding in some particularly progressive schemes where you know, maybe it's a company really shooting for the stars and they want to, I'm just putting this out there, they want a net zero commercial block of flats or offices, new headquarters, whatever it's going to be, and it seems completely pie in the sky to a lot of the people on the team who aren't used to delivering that. But that lofty, in many respects, the loftier your goal, the earlier you've got to have good advice.
And why is that?
Simply because the margin for error is so much tighter. You know, the difference between somebody building a commercial block of flats to building regs and somebody building a commercial block of flats to a net zero standard, whilst it's not 100 times as complicated, if you leave certain key discussions and decisions a few months, 6 months, 9 months, you know, in more traditional kind of development, it amplifies. And you, we all know there are critical points on a project where you simply can't stop or you can't go back. It's too expensive.
Yeah, you can't go back.
You just can't do it.
Yeah,
and
something, yeah,
yeah. Everybody in the room realizes that somebody's dropped an absolute clanger, but you just can't stop. The momentum's there in a particular direction. And what is even worse, and what this is, you know, as specialists, we all have these kind of nodes where if you don't get the right answer or you're not feeling comfortable at that particular node, you know the rest is just going to be an absolute mess.
Exactly.
And
yeah, exactly.
One of the first nodes that we pick up on, particularly with schemes that are, let's say, have lofty sustainability goals, but they can't actually quantify what they're doing. Like, you know, this block of flats wants to be a pilot scheme and it's gonna be the most sustainable building in, let's pick Norwich. Let's pick Norwich of all places.
Yeah, yeah. We'll roll with Norwich.
But at that early stage, you know, REBA stage one, you're supposed to be figuring out what the goal is, what you're gonna do, what you're gonna commit to. And so if you start talking to somebody REBA stage two or REBA stage three, you've just got this disproportionate, this is what we're doing, but nobody's actually written it down. And if you can't write it down or commit to it, there's a whole load of things that cascade from that that mean something for the design development. You know, and coming on to kind of project risks, you know, it affects everybody and can get very, very messy if you leave that too long. I mean, you know, the guys on site, that seems like a million miles away from somebody in a boardroom having a discussion about whether it's going to be, you know, the next best thing to happen in Norwich. But but honestly, it affects everybody because, again, you end up with this, what should have been an incredible development, just getting watered down into
and
complete.
And so what happens if you sat down, you come back into the office on Monday morning and you get this inquiry on your desk and it says, we're at stage four or we're at stage three and we're now looking to engage mesh and blah, blah, blah. How do you internally assess that? I know each project
is
unique.
Am I allowed to say on this podcast?
Honesty is key. Honesty is key.
How do we assess that? I think, yeah, a bit of a red flag is more often than not in some of the first emails or communications that you get. Because if you're in those latter stages and somebody starts mentioning, you know, BREEAM, excellent or outstanding or you know, net zero, these other kind of terms. And in the next sentence, they say, oh, but by the way, we haven't talked to anybody yet. So then, you know, there aren't that many projects which are past the point of no return, but there are certain kind of key phrases.
And that still happens, does it?
You do wonder how some schemes have got as far as they have done. Whatever you say about, you know, kind of planning in the UK at the moment, planning has really tightened down on more progressive schemes and what's needed at that stage. So you can't get too ahead of yourself to get that through planning. But there are still some schemes that have just scraped through, you know, the old regulations and old planning system, and, you know, want to go somewhere that they're simply just not, they're too far gone, And I think, you know, there is a responsibility, and particularly on, you know, particularly for us to just say, you know, I'm sorry, there's too big of a disconnect here. You can kind of carry on, you know, kind of cloud cuckoo land and continue to be disappointed, and you're not going to end up with what you think you do. Or, you know, how long do you want to pause this project for to sort this out? And depending on the response, you know, it's like a thanks very much, we'd love to be part of this.
Yay or nay.
No, but here's a competitor that you can work with if you like.
Deary me. Okay, so we've really framed the conversation quite nicely, I think, in the first half, and I understand quite a lot about timing, the Reba stage, where you think you should come in. In the second half, just want to talk about how you best interact with the other key stakeholders from the design team, and then we'll talk about risk as well. But we will do that, Doug, after this break. Records, records, records. So often you hear this phrase in construction, don't you? Transparency between main and subcontractors can always be a challenge, and I've been on both sides of the table, so I understand. Our app, C-Link, fosters engagement and records all the communications for both main and subcontractors through the tender and contract process. That means you're going to reduce your risks, reduce disputes, and reduce miscommunication. Imagine a world where you had all of your tender addendums, all of your tender communications, every drawing, every document you'd ever created on a tender process recorded, not just for one subcontractor, but for every subcontractor. It will massively reduce the chance of variations, massively reduce the chance of miscommunication and disputes, and that's what we've built at C-Link. To find out more, go and watch the video that's in the show notes right now, and then book a demo, and one of our team will walk you through exactly how it works. So, design services. I think I'm just about keeping my head above water so far, although I'm not sure. Maybe I'll ask Doug when we're not recording and he'll tell me completely differently. But what I want to talk to you about now is, just as a consultant consulting on the things that you do as part of that design team process, Doug, I'm interested to understand from your perspective, like I said, I only know mine as a subby. Your perspective, how do you see the relation, the best possible relationship that you could have first with the architect?
So I think the best possible relationship, you know, I'm drawing on examples of great relationships that we've built and come from success here, and that's all that we can do, I suppose. But it's really about, you know, one is always mutual trust. You firmly believe that you're paying a consultant good money, like you would do a subcontractor, and they're going to do the job that they are signed up to do, rather than signing you up and then the architect believes that, you know, 80% of what they're saying is better than the 100% of what you're saying. So having that kind of mutual respect for your area of specialisms, but an empathy, of course, for things that might not go your way, or you know, kind of may think differently, or kind of jar with the way you particularly do things or think. So that's the first one, and the second one is really, I think, and architects have a massive part to play in this, is getting the client properly engaged in what is going on. I think, you know, commercially, that can be more difficult. I think it depends on the commercial job. You know, again, oversimplifying, commercially, sometimes there can be too many layers of stakeholders involved. That's where domestically it's far easier, because you've got a client, you've got an architect, you might have a few specialists.
Very hyper-engaged
and, yeah,
client.
And some clients want to be really engaged, so you want to be part of every conversation. But I think what is really, really critical, and going back to talk about money and profit, and the numbers have to stack up for this project to continue going commercially, we have to make sure, and the architect has to make sure, that, again, that relationship between the client, whoever the stakeholder is that is worth engaging with, and the architect, again, trust one another, because there are plenty of great projects where, again, the client has understood that what the architect is saying, with their experience that they've got and all these specialisms, is there is a very good reason why they've had a really important meeting about this really important thing that has to be discussed, because it can change the way or the level of success the project has going on. And if that, again, if that trust isn't there between the client and the architect, you don't get that time to stop and think. People get steamrolled and all of a sudden the architect feels they're just kind of doing things because the client wants them to, rather than really listening. There's a reason why architects have often been appointed. You know, they're not the only one they've spoken to. Yet very few architects get listened to enough.
You know? Is that really how you feel? Because, you know, it's funny hearing that from, and again, each project is different, isn't it? And I was working on massive, massive projects. You'd often feel like you were almost getting steamrolled a little bit by the architect from a subcontract perspective.
I think it can happen each which way. And again, it comes back to mutual respect. You know, I know there are always lots of different, you know, there's politics and pressure and this, that, and the, of course, you know, I mean, it wouldn't be any kind of project with that kind of stuff going on. But I think there is, without wanting to get too fluffy about this, that again, the most successful teams, and the architect is part of this and other specialists, is we've really got to get better at bringing proper teams together as early as possible. Again, it comes back to what we talked about in the first half, and getting away from this such and such knows better than such and such. You've got your specialist areas, but I think there's got to be a lot more talking, empathy, consideration for what others do know in a rapidly changing construction environment. And this is something, again, that we'll kind of come to talk about when we're talking about risk, is so much is changing. We have to be far more adaptable as a group trying to build this thing.
As opposed to being in these...
Yeah. It's whenever has something, you know, in a rapidly changing environment, doing something and not changing it been successful? You just get more and more out of touch. You get, you know, less and less competitive. Things just start going wrong. And when things go wrong, they cost money.
I think what's really interesting, just listening to you talk there, is the word rapidly changing environment, because I think there'll be lots of people listening thinking, are we in a rapidly changing environment? And maybe that is fundamental risk one. And I'm making a note of that. And
yeah, definitely. Let's talk about that. That's important.
Before we move on, just on the topic of the architect, as a consultant that would typically be employed, I guess, either by the architect directly or by the client directly, you know, so I guess either you're employed by the principal designer, typically the architect, or client. What for you are the like pros and cons of both? Like, what do you prefer?
We definitely prefer just being employed by the client. I would say the vast majority of work that we do is, you know, we're employed directly by the client. And the reason is, I mean, there have been a few occasions where, you know, we've asked the question, who we're being appointed by and who we're signing a contract with. And more often than not, the architects say, the client. We're juggling 100 things as it is. That we don't want another cash flow problem. It's just kind of answer what we do. And that's fine by us, because honestly, as a business owner, you know, as every business owner who's got staff should know, you know, all that matters is that flow of money and making sure you can pay your staff in a timely fashion. And if there are just more people in those steps to get paid, you just get paid later and later and later. And as long as you're pretty confident in the job that you're doing, I personally don't feel there's a big issue working directly with the client. And it's been very, very successful for us.
That makes sense. It's pretty clear. And it basically flow of cash being the primary instinct there, which makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really, really sad to hear, you know, about so many businesses that are businesses that are going out of business in the construction sector. You know, it's a difficult time for the construction sector. And that's where my mind just keeps coming back to it. You know, get as close as you can to the source of the money and not be fourth or fifth in the line to get paid. It's just kind of it's common sense. I know some people might be scared by that or want extra protection, but for us, you know, we know we do a great job and we'd happily sit in front of a client and justify what we need to justify to get paid on time.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so just tweaking the conversation slightly before we get to risk, the last question really about design team and process and like how you interact, how do you see your relationship with like the main and subcontractors?
Yes, this is an interesting one. I mean, kind of full disclosure, a lot of the work that we do, as you know, is front end loaded, and not enough projects, not enough projects have the main contractor and some key contractors, you know, involved at those early stages. So we spend 90% of our time talking to the architect, talking to the client, talking to the structural engineer, talking to the landscape architect, you know, whoever it's going to be. But, you know, when we do interact with the main contractor and subcontractors, again, it's, we have some very, very progressive projects that we're working on. And it just one this morning that I was talking to, you know, they had the principal contractor, you know, they were starting to bring other people to the table.
Lots of early engagement.
Yeah, and it's literally, it's literally just got planning. And it's great to see that. It's odd because you've got so many faces on a meeting and you're not kind of used to that, I guess. But when you've got the main contractor in early, like I was saying, you know, the main contractor knows stuff that we don't know. They've got different pressures. They've got different important nodes that they've got to hit that they think are important. I don't know, because that's not my, you know, that's not my bag. I think I know, and I could probably take a guess if something, but you know, every project's different.
But equally, you wouldn't want the main contractor taking a guess at your nodes.
Exactly. And they are just another critical member of the team. And, you know, if the designers have got their work right, I mean, that, to be honest, that doesn't count for much if it can't be executed properly on site. And what you're trying to do, again, some of the more, kind of progressive main contractors that we've come up against, ask in a nice kind of polite way, or try and solve, should I say, some of the more difficult pressing questions that they know they're going to come up against in 6 months, 9 months time in the build program. They're, you know, we're sitting down with the build program, because that's what they're going to help get held accountable for, and overrun is going to cost money, and it's all going to come back on them. So you sit down with them early doors before, you know, diggers have rolled on site and you're moving earth and concrete mixers are there, and the brickies or whatever are there, and the cranes are on site. And again, you're talking to this team at an early stage, saying, knowing what we know, what's going to be painful, how do we fix it now, explain how we've got to this stage, so I'm not undoing all that good work, you know, because there's always doubt in subcontractors' mind. They're like, oh, well, you know, Doug's done this scheme, but it doesn't really mean much to me, so I'm just going to do what I normally do. I'm sure he hasn't put that much thinking into it.
yeah. But that kind of is how, from a subcontract side, and again, this is wildly generalizing, but, you know, there is an absolute disconnect from the team on site delivering it 9 months on from when you have designed it or you've had your fingerprints. Just that sentence shows the disconnect, but it breeds a culture, doesn't it? And it sounds to me, again, and this is simple and simplifying the entire complexity of it, but just having the main contractor in the room, if you're the client, to have the main contractor in that room with you, the situation you're describing there, brings endless value. Because, like, there's things that are being solved today that are going to get you in June, July, September, December, which it's not that simple, but it makes sense. In short, what you're kind of saying is you want, like, the more engagement, the better, with whether it's architect, main contractor, or even specialists.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think underlying all of this is, and this is, I'm trying to think of the right word for this, but in an ideal world, everybody on a project should be properly engaged in what they're doing and the reason why it's being done. You know, how many disaffected, you know, subcontractors and even main contractors, I guess, do we kind of come across? And again, there isn't that kind of respect. But I think what the other thing, certainly from a client's point of view, if I was a client and I had millions of quid to spend on a block of flats being built or a new office headquarters, you know, I would want to know or speak to and find out what some of these key players were made of as early as possible. Because I think if they're not properly engaged and they're not prepared to be engaged early on, they just want to be left to kind of do their bit.
It's a bit disenchanted really from the end goal.
That warns of other issues which invariably come out, either whether it's poor communication or, again, lack of respect for other people that they're dealing with. And I think some of this necessary change should, in theory, help projects out, because it weeds out those who just haven't got the right stuff and haven't got the ability to make successful goes of modern projects.
Yeah, the challenge undoubtedly for any clients listening to this is, you know, the procurement methods that we've currently got set up, the procurement routes that we've got set up, budgetary challenges, time challenges, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it brings me on nicely, and I realize, I feel like this is probably a whole nother episode that I'm going to try and shoehorn into a single question or two now. So apologies for that, but we've talked for quite extensively on other topics, which has been really interesting. So we kind of have our current framework for running projects and, you know, the train tracks on which construction runs, right? We have design process, contract process, all these different things which everyone listening will be relatively accustomed with, whether it's an NEC, a JCT, whatever. You talked about we're in a rapidly changing environment. I honestly believe, and I work in construction technology, I feel like we're in quite a rapidly changing environment. However, I believe that the vast majority in construction don't necessarily think we're in a rapidly changing environment. And that, when you said that, it resonated. What's your view on that? Are we in a rapidly changing environment? And if so, what does that mean for project risks?
Yes, I do believe that we're in a rapidly changing environment. I think it's sometimes difficult to see on projects. And I was thinking about this just whilst you were talking there, actually, because when a project gets consent, you're almost in a kind of a time warp. So you've got these regulations that, or these this set of conditions, the kind of the playing field is mapped out. You know, you must do X, Y, Z. It's all really good.
You're in it for 12 months.
And then it, yeah, exactly. 12 or 24 or 36, depending on how big the project is. And you're kind of moving with that. But it's, you know, it's completely different frames of reference just because you're on a project and very few, I mean, I don't know, I guess it depends on the size of your company, really. Maybe you're on that one project for 24 months, 48 months, 36 months.
But even if you're on two or three, you're kind of locked into that period or those regulations anyway.
But in the meantime, so you're in this kind of like time warp, this like kind of main contractor, subcontractor time warp, and you're rocking up to the same site every day and, you know, and funny enough, something's coming out of the ground eventually and then you're topping out and then you're first fix, second fix, blah, blah. But meanwhile, everything outside of that building site is zip, zip, zip. I mean, you know, just to have a look at how building regulations, just Part L, let's just take Part L, kind of energy conservation and power, you know, talks about carbon emissions and, you know, you've got to do all these kind of compliance calculations for it. You know, in the last 10 years, we have come, you know, a massive step. The last set of regulations was huge. In 2 years' time, the middle of the decade, it's changing again. And we're on this kind of hockey stick change. And that's one building regulation for carbon emissions. So that's one like tiny little bit. So in the time when you're on one or two projects, when you kind of come out of those, or you start looking for new work to follow on from those, the step, the jump in thinking and materials that you're using and techniques is changed. And, you know,
sorry to interrupt you. I think it is. I've never considered it in that context, you know, where you do, as a contractor, you do go onto a site, even as like, depending on the size of different design teams, you go onto a site or onto a project and often you're locked in. I said 12 months, it's kind of like your minimum, right? And you are like in that vortex of quite like that description of, you've got a gun to your head, I've got to deliver this on time, I've got to deliver it on budget, within these regulations to this spec, blah, 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 blah. You do not care about what is going on elsewhere. You've got enough to deal with, right? But that does then mean, particularly on these bigger jobs, that then you come back out 3 years, you come out of the vortex, and yeah, everything has changed. And from a contractor's perspective, particularly QS, we'll deliver what we need to deliver, if that kind of makes sense, whatever the spec says, etc. So when you talk about rapidly changing environment and there is a huge amount of risk around that, could you explain what you mean by that? I appreciate that's an open question.
Yeah, what I mean by, I mean, there are so many strands of this. I mean, this is a whole podcast series, but yeah, I think really this is the nub of this, as the nub for any risk really, is what elements of the project that you are either directly involved in or, you know, secondary or tertiary involved in, essentially what can cost money that you're not expecting that, you know, that project to incur. Some of these things can be very, very obvious and some can be very, very insidious. and you don't find out until it's very, very late. But the kinds of risks are multi layered. But at the end of the day, they always come back to having everything from a difficult conversation that kind of suggests that you don't really know what you're talking about, or something where the project has to stop, or the client's got to find another £250,000 because something has been overlooked, which, you know, nobody foresaw. But more often than not, risk always comes back to the client spending more money than they had budgeted for, you know, in a high level sense. But it can affect every single person on the, you know, or a tradesperson or designer on the project. And a lot of that, just to kind of pick up on the point about the rapidly changing environment that we're in, I think the single biggest risk here is that you don't understand that it's rapidly changing. And one of the biggest risks, certainly for those who've been in the construction industry for decades, who still think they've got a couple of decades to go. I mean, that's the most risky. The guys or women who are on the verge of retirement, not such a big deal. But for those who are in the middle of their careers, you know, and have learned how to build commercial projects a certain way, some of that experience is okay. But, and this is quite controversial, increasingly experience is pretty meaningless, because you're basing decisions today on something that happened two projects ago, but stuff changed so rapidly that you can't rely on that as much.
That I understand. What I am missing is an example of what has changed. Like, to really contextualize it, could you say, like, for example, this has changed and...
Okay, so a really obvious one is building overheating. And this definitely is a big, big factor for commercial projects. So for a long, long time, overheating, there were some simple kind of checks in some of the compliance documentation about thermal comfort in, let's say, a block of flats. You know, you've got single aspect rooms with ideally a lot of glazing, usually in cities, which are warmer anyway, multiple stories, not easy to kind of get ventilation into these spaces. Now that there's a new overheating regulation in, and go back to risk, I can think of, out of the hundreds and hundreds of projects that we've analysed, one, and I mean one, passed first time under that regulation. So as a design team, you're an architect with 30 years experience. You've been designing buildings, unwittingly or not, that don't meet the latest overheating standard. And what that means is occupants will get too warm. You know, it affects learning and sleeping and all these kinds of things. So on the design side, that's one single bit of compliance, which is creating a big, big headache for people who've been in the industry for many, many, many years. The on-site one that I would cite is actually, and again, this is quite an insidious one, and this is really about construction detail and airtightness of buildings. So there's been a big, big push to reduce the airtightness on schemes. Mechanical ventilation, heat recovery, you know, people listening to the podcast will be familiar with. So the building is less leaky, right? So you have to do air tests. It may be that, you know, you're trying to meet a you know, very, very tight performance standard for the building. And air tightness, I mean, how easy is it to figure out where air is being lost when you're building it? You know, the designers have put a fair amount of effort into detailing the building, but then you've got guys drilling holes through exterior walls, and you've got stuff being not fitted quite as snugly as it should do. So on site, something as simple as, right, you know, your previous project had an air tightness value of 5, which is kind of regular building standards level. Now you're on a project that needs an air tightness value of 2. That doesn't sound like much of a change. What is changing is now you're in the realms of mechanical ventilation, heat recovery. You've got a completely different... You've gone from natural ventilation to a mechanical ventilation system. The difference between achieving 5 and 2, it's not as difficult as achieving 0.6, but, you know, the checks and balances and workmanship
And what you need to include as a contractor, subcontractor to manage that QA process.
Somebody overseeing that? Who's going to champion that? If nobody really understands it or nobody really cares, you can guarantee you're going to probably get worse than five. So, you know, just a couple of numbers or a regulation change, and that's just a couple of fairly simple examples. If you can't be prepared to learn what that means in the context of what you're doing, whether you're down in the trenches, you know, building the thing, or if you're high and dry, a bit like me in behind the desk designing something, that's risk and that's money and that's project delay. And that's a really annoyed client who may be taking legal action against you. You know, these have very, you know, the ripple effect, particularly on commercial projects, is huge, as you all know, but the seed can be very, very small. And that's why we've got to keep learning. It's a massive potential risk.
I think it's fascinating, A, to just see the absolute animation and passion that you have for this, because clearly you're seeing it on projects.
Costs a fortune. You know, costs a fortune, some of this stuff. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think, as you said, there's probably a whole, not even another episode, there's probably a whole series we could do on this where we actually go into depth on it. But I think as a starter, people listening, you know, and I think to me at least, that insular project vortex is, as I'm going to trademark that and I'm going to copyright it and take it, that's mine now, but that mentality of I am in this project does therefore mean that it is very difficult to zoom out. But I think the examples that you've set out do for me resonate and will allow people to think, you know, maybe there's other things that I need to start considering, and et cetera, et cetera, and so much more. And what I will do is, as always, I will share your LinkedIn. I'll share your Mesh's details as well in the show notes. And I believe it may be necessary at some point in the future for us to get back together and maybe go into more depth on some of these items. But thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Doug.
Yeah, absolutely. A pleasure too. And yeah, shame we couldn't have talked for longer.
I know, indeed, mate. Awesome. And guys, I will be back next week. I will speak to you then.